by a physico, whether he liked it or not. "You're not mad," said Locke.
"Of course not. I presume you two idiots hinted to one another about relighting old fires."
"That was my distinct impression."
"Well, assuming you don't let her drug you again, I'm proud of you. I'm the last man on earth who'd discourage you from chasing the woman you adore. Believe me, see to business and then make it as personal as possible."
"Thanks." Locke grinned and enjoyed a brief moment of actual relaxation, one that ended as soon as he blinked and realized that Patience was seated just across from him, lips folded into a scowl below her night-dark eyes.
"I'd say you're placing an alarming emphasis on pleasure over responsibility, wouldn't you?" she said.
"Gods above!"
Locke edged away from her reflexively and saw Jean flinch as well.
"Why couldn't you show up on the street like an ordinary person?"
"I'm no good at being an ordinary person. Your recent behavior has been darkly amusing, but I must confess that my colleagues and I are starting to worry about the effectiveness of your overall plan of resistance, if indeed such a plan exists."
"It had to be set aside for a few days," said Locke. "We did manage to escape total humiliation, no thanks to you."
"How would you know where the thanks should fall?"
"I don't remember you offering us a spare boat and a hot meal when we were trying not to drown," said Jean.
"And seasonal hard winds blew you off course for most of a week, leaving you within spitting distance of shore, and you didn't stop to ponder the implications?"
"Wait," said Locke. "I thought you were strictly forbidden from—"
"I won't confirm or refute any conjecture," said Patience, sounding satisfied as a cream-fed cat. "I'm merely pointing out that your vaunted imagination seemed to be flickering rather dimly. Of course, it's possible we aided you. It's possible the other side had bent the rules as well and earned a bit of a rebuke. You'll never know for sure."
"Damn it, Patience," said Locke. "You were at pains to assure us that the rules of your stupid contest are ironclad.
And you were at pains to insist that you didn't trust me any farther than you could throw this carriage.
Why the hell are you even here? Do you have some message?"
"The message is this. Mind your task, Locke Lamora. You're here to win, not to woo."
"I'm here to do both. Carte blanche was the deal. Are you reneging?"
"I'm just relaying.
My disinterest in your bullshit is so tangible you could make bricks out of it. Carte blanche. Yes or no?"
"Yes," she said. "But you should be very, very careful how long you test our forbearance. When dealing with a horse that won't make speed, one tends to apply a whip to its flanks, doesn't one?"
"You told me you people love to sit back and watch your agents run around entertaining you. So kindly sit back, shut up, and be entertained."
"I intend to be," she said.
Between heartbeats, she was gone, without so much as a rustle of fabric.
"God damn it," said Locke. "Tell me I wouldn't be such a tremendous pain in the arse if I had those powers." "You'd be worse," sighed Jean. "I'd have killed you myself a long time ago. And you know what else?"
"Hmm?"
"Patience can lick scorpions in hell. You and Sabatha take your time and sort out whatever the last 5 years have done to you. I'm here to mind the shop whenever you're out."
4.
"Oh, gods!"
said Nikoros, who was sitting at Jostin's bar behind a half-finished drink that was a bit too large and a bit too early in the day.
"Oh, thank the gods! Where have you two been?"
"On the road, dear fellow," said Locke, seizing Nikoros around the shoulders and pulling him to his feet. Locke ground his teeth as he noticed the sharp smell of something alchemical on Nikoros' breath and his dilated pupils, but there was no time to berate him just now. "Engaged in terribly important secret affairs. Where do we stand?"
"We're, beset by unexpected complications," said Nikoros, bewildered. "We're getting our asses kicked. The bookmakers are projecting a 14-seat council majority for the black—"
"That's great," said Locke, flush with the heady exhilaration that comes from absolute freedom to bullshit absolutely.
"That's excellent. That's the whole point of the exercise. Master Callus and I have been making careful arrangements to create the false impression of a total state of disarray on our side.
Get it? We've got the Black Iris right where we want them.
Really?
Hope brought new colour to Nikoros' face with startling speed, and Locke sighed. Between whatever he'd been drinking and the adjustments of the bonds magi, Nikoros probably had the free will of a sponge.
That sounds great!
Doesn't it? Said Locke. Now summon a physica. Then grab every trustworthy dog's body and scribe you can lay hands on and bring them up to me in the Deep Roots private gallery in 5 minutes. Go, go, go! Jostin?
At your service, Master Lazari.
Food for 5 hungry fat men in the private gallery as soon as possible.
I gave some orders when I saw you walk in.
Bless you. Master Callus will want coffee, too, hot enough to strip paint. Did you have any problems while we were away? Security trouble?
Your people caught half a dozen folks trying to break in, sent them off with bad headaches. They also tell me we're being watched from several points around the neighborhood.
We'll tend to that soon enough. Locke beckoned for Jean to follow, and the two of them passed through the crowd of afternoon business folk and traders, exchanging friendly nods with deep-root supporters barely remembered from the night of Nikoros' party. In moments, they were up in the party's private gallery, temporarily alone.
"Is there an actual plan running around in your head?"
wheezed Jean. "Crap sparks until something catches fire." Locke settled into a high-backed chair and brushed dust from his filthy tunic. Noise and action to keep Sabatha guessing while we cook up a real scheme. We start with childish pranks and escalate steadily. Gods, I wish we had some proper urchins, some right people that knew what they were doing. Komori outlaws had never thought very highly of their fraternal associates in other cities, but Carthane was the least regarded of all. Locke hadn't once heard of a Carthani gang that had any reach, any of the savage pride or inventiveness that Komori, Verari, or even Lashani crews took for granted.
"It's the presence," said Jean. "The Bonds Magi have these people tamed."
Food and coffee were the first of the commanded resources to arrive. Locke scarfed down meat and bread. Neither lingered long enough before his eyes or in his mouth for full identification. Jean sipped coffee and ate a roll, almost daintily, with obvious discomfort. A few moments later, a dark-skinned woman with neat grey hair came up the stairs carrying a leather bag.
"I'm Scholar Triassa," she said, frowning at Jean, "and that nose tells quite a story."
While she began her examination, tactfully saying nothing about the fact that Locke and Jean smelled like goats, Nikoros and half a dozen scribes and assistants came up the stairs.
"Good,"
said Locke, gulping a last bite of food. "It's time to give those Black Iris gits a taste of some friendly piss artistry. Wet your quills. Scribe everything down exactly. Give your notes to Nikoros when we're finished, and he'll handle the actual work assignments. I want a letter drafted immediately to the Chief Constable of Lashane, whoever that is. Tell them that 4 horses stolen from an armoured carriage service bound for Lashane have been located in the stables at the sign of the Black Iris in Carthane. Each horse has a clearly visible brand on its neck. These horses were received as stolen property and not reported to the Carthani authorities. Sign it, a friend, and get it to the very next ship crossing the Amethel with mail." Jean chuckled, then grunted as Scholar Triassa continued her work. Locke paced back and forth as he spoke. "Tomorrow I'll secure an addition to party funds. I want 1,000 ducats handed out to trustworthy Deep Roots members in increments of 5 to 20 ducats apiece. I want them all to go out this week and place bets with anyone taking them on the Deep Roots winning the election. I want a sudden surge of Deep Roots confidence so the opposition can have a good hard worry about the possibility that we know something they don't. I want another 1,000 spent on cakes and wine, rigged up in baskets with green ribbons. Complimentary baskets go to the houses of tradesfolk, merchants, alchemists, scribes, physicers, anyone respectable that isn't already part of the Deep Roots family. Let's go wooing new voters. That might, cause a problem with some of the, senior party members," said Nikoros. "Traditionally, we're very choosy about new members. We have private salons by invitation. We don't, sweep the streets for recruits." Locke poured a mug of coffee and took a long sip.
And for those refined tastes, you idiots have been crowded out hard in the last two elections, he thought. Am I in charge here, Nikoros?
Oh, gods, yes, absolutely, sir. I didn't mean to imply anything other.
We will sweep the streets for recruits if it comes to that. I'll put a bag of gold in the hands of any brick-witted cross-eyed sheep-fucker who can mark a parchment. Any time you want to question me, remind yourself that the opposition doesn't share your delicate god's damned traditions. All they care about is winning.
Of course.
The baskets go out. No demands, no obligations, not yet. We just want people thinking kindly of us. Arm-twisting comes later. More quietly, he continued, hunt down our party members with debts, troubles in court, that sort of thing. Give me a list of their little problems and we'll send people out to fix them. In exchange, we'll own their asses and set them toiling. Now, conversely, black Aris party members with weaknesses, debts, affairs, scandals, addictions, legal entanglements, I want that list. I want to scratch every wound, pour vinegar in every cut, pluck every low-hanging fruit. Constant total harassment, seizing any opportunity they give us, starting before the sun rises again.
As you wish, said Nikoros.
To that end, I need a trustworthy alchemist. I need a wagon, a few dozen small animal cages, as many live snakes as we can get our hands on.
Live snakes? Said one of the scribes. You mean...
Yeah, said Locke. They've got scales. They slither around. Snakes. Keep up. We only want 'em if they're not venomous. That means barn serpents, brown marshes, belt snakes. Anything else you have in these parts that fits the bill. Use mercenaries, boys, girls, anyone. Offer a suitable bounty, but keep it God's damned quiet. I don't want word of this little project going too far. Drop the cages in the cellar and keep the snakes there until further notice. How's Master Callus knows?
Badly set, said the physicker. I gather from your rather forthright aroma that you gentlemen have been unable to rest for several days.
Woefully correct, said Locke.
It'll have to be rebroken. It's plain this isn't your first such injury, Master Callus, and you're developing a breathing obstruction.
Then do it, said Jean.
I'll need 2 cups of brandy, some assistance, and some rope.
No time for all that, growled Jean. And I want my head clear for work. Just do it here and now.
Your pardon, Master Callus, but I don't relish the thought of a man your size lashing out at me.
Scholar, said Locke, this building is more likely to collapse than my friend is to lose control of himself.
I'm doubling my fee, said the woman sternly.
And I'm tripling it, said Jean. Go on, snap the damn thing to where it ought to be. I've had worse, and I've had it without warning.
Triassa placed her hands carefully, as though Jean's head were a clay sculpture, and she meant to pinch the nose off and start over. She applied pressure with one smooth motion. Jean remained still, but did indulge in a long, deep, appropriately theatrical groan. The sound of whatever was moving or breaking inside the nose itself made Locke shudder, as though his privates had just been dipped in ice water, and a collective gasp arose from the scribes.
"Perhaps just one small brandy," rasped Jean, barely moving his lips.
Tears ran down his cheeks. Locke pointed at one of the scribes. The woman nodded and hurried out of the gallery. Triassa deftly set Jean's nose in cream-colored alchemical plasters and wrapped linen around his head.
"Keep this in place," she said. "You've danced this dance before, so don't do anything foolish. Brace your head while you sleep. Come see me tomorrow. I'm across the street."
"Thanks," said Jean.
A moment later, the helpful scribe returned with a glass of caramel brown liquor, which Jean poured carefully down his throat. "Well then," said Locke, "now that we've all realized precisely how tough we'll never be, let's stand on what we have. Pass your lists to Nikoros, and he'll mind the details."
"Sirs," said Nikoros, as his hands rapidly filled with papers, "I'm pleased to see you back and taking a more active role in our affairs, but, this volume of work..."
"Don't fret, Nikoros. There's plenty of time, assuming none of us sleeps before dawn." Locke gave Nikoros a reassuring squeeze on the arm, then lowered his voice to a private whisper.
"Also, if I catch you stuffing another speck of black alchemy down your throat, your job situation is going to be vacant. Understand?"
"Master Lazari, sir, what can I say? I'm ashamed. But you were gone. Everything was so confused."
"Everything is now unconfused. We're going to have baths drawn and rejoin civilization. Get to work. Get me that list and get me that alchemist. There's two ladies in particular waiting to see what we've got up our sleeves, and it's time for things to get hectic."
Of course, Master Lazari." "Nikoros?"
Yes, sir."
"I just had a really exciting thought. Get me the list, the alchemist, and then get me a city constable. A well-bent one. Someone who thinks with their purse and isn't shy about it."
Certainly, but it may take...
"Tonight, Nikoros, tonight."
5. Locke and Jean found steaming baths in their suite, along with more food and enough towels, body scrapers, and scented oil jars to supply a rather hygienic harem. Refreshed and repackaged in respectable outer layers, they returned to the Deep Roots private gallery to find Nikoros waiting, new papers in hand. Locke scanned them as rapidly as the crabbed handwriting would permit.
"Good, good," he muttered. "Debts, lots of debts. Eager little gamblers are Black Ari's friends. Who'd be holding most of these?"
"Most of the debts that aren't between gentlefolk would involve Fifth Son Lucidus over in the Velverda. Well, he owns the chance houses in the Velverda, but he lives somewhere on Issus Meadow."
"Lovely," said Locke. "A little Duke of the Dice Dens. He's not a big player in either political party, is he?"
"Doesn't give a damn about the elections as far as I know."
"Better and better," said Locke. "Exactly the sort of man Master Callus and I should see in the small hours of the night, like dutiful physicers paying a house call."
"Physicers?"
"Absolutely. We want him firmly convinced that if he disregards our advice, his health is apt to suffer. Now, where's my alchemist and my constable?"
"Coming, Master Lazari, coming."
6. The moons were shy in just the way thieves prefer, hidden behind clouds like black wool, and the brisk south wind carried the scents of lake water and forge smoke. Banked down furnaces were faint smudges of red and orange nestled among the shadows of the Isle of Hammers, and the view from the window of Fifth Son Lucidus' third-story bedroom captured it all nicely. Locke took a moment to properly appreciate the tableau before he turned and woke Lucidus with a slap to the face.
"Oomph!" said the heavy-set Carthani.
His exclamation was muffled by Jean, who, standing behind his bed, slapped one hand over his mouth and hauled him to a sitting position with the other.
"Shh!" said Locke, who sat down at Lucida's feet. He adjusted the aperture of his dark lantern to throw a thin beam directly on the bearded and bleary-eyed fellow, whose face wore the sort of extra years that came out of a wine bottle.
"Your first thought will be to struggle. So I'd like you to think about where and how deep I can cut you while leaving you perfectly capable of conversation."
He unsheathed a long, freshly polished steel blade, and was sure to catch the lantern light with it before he slapped Lucida's legs with the flat of the weapon.
"Your second thought," said Locke, who wore an improvised grey linen mask, "will be to summon that big man who's supposed to be watching your front door. I'm afraid we've put him to sleep for a bit. So now my associate will take his hand off your mouth, and you'll mind your tone of voice."
"Who the hell are you?" whispered Lucidus.
"What we are is the important thing. We're better than you. There's no defense you can dream up and no hole you can hide in that will keep us from doing this to you any time we please."
What do you want?"
"Take a good look at these names." Locke sheathed the blade and pulled out a torn sheet of parchment with a short list on it. The names had been culled from the larger list provided by Nikoros. They weren't merely opposition voters, but components of varying importance in the Black Aris political machine. "Some of these men and women owe you money, yes?"
"Yes,"
said Lucidus, squinting at the parchment.
"Yes, most of them, in fact."
"Good," said Locke. "Because you're about to have some money problems, understand?
You're going to call in your markers on all of these fine citizens.
Wait, Chester!
This last exclamation was a result of Jean reasserting his presence, without prompting from Locke, via the careful application of a forearm to Lucidus' windpipe.
"I'm not soliciting opinions," said Locke, gesturing for Jean to ease up. "I'm giving orders. Yank the leash on these people, or bad luck follows. Chance houses burn down. Nice homes like this burn down. The tendons in your legs get slashed. Understood?"
"Yes, yes."
"About those money issues." Locke held up a purse, stuffed near bursting with about 10 pounds of coins, and Lucida's eyes went wide. "A hidden floor panel? Seriously? I was learning how to spot that sort of thing when I was 6. You squeeze these people hard, get it? Collect the debts. Do your best, and you'll get this purse back, plus 100 ducats. That's nothing to scoff at, is it?"
No. "Fuck it up," said Locke,
lowering his voice to a growl, "and this money vanishes. Try to cross me, and I'll carve you like a festival roast. Get to work tomorrow, and don't worry about looking for us. When we want to talk again, we'll find you." 7.
"Now tell us," said Jean,
staring down at a detailed map of Carthane with all of its avenues and islands,
"which districts are usually considered an absolute lock for either party?"
It was deepening evening, the day after their midnight visit to the house of Fifth Son Lucidus. Locke and Jean were in the private gallery with Damned Superstition Dexa and First Son Epitalus. Nikoros, who'd been worked like a clockwork automaton for longer than Locke had intended, had passed out in a high-backed chair. Whether it was honest fatigue or alchemically induced, Locke allowed him to snore on for the time being.
"We've got all the right places, dear boy," said Dexa, pointing to the southeastern portion of the map. "Isasmelia, Thedra, and Jonquin. The Three Sisters, the old money districts. The Silver Chase and Vorhalla routinely come back 8/10 deep roots as well."
"As for the opposition," said Epitalus, "they've got the Isle of Hammers and the surrounding neighbourhoods. Baresta, Merrow, Lacor, Agaro, shop and trade districts, you see."
Epitalus exhaled twin streams of white pipe smoke from his nostrils, and brief-lived cloud formations drifted over the illustrated city.
"New men and women, ink still wet on the receipts for their voting privileges, eh?"
"So it's 5 against 5, said Locke, "and the other 9 districts are in play?"
"More or less," said Dexa. "Sentiment across the city..."
"Can go hang itself," said Locke. "Here's the basic plan, as much as I can reveal now. We keep most of our money out of the settled districts. We don't have time to turn the Black Iris strongholds, and we shouldn't have to worry about them turning ours. We'll run some misdirection and some nice childish pranks, but most of our leverage gets thrown against the 9 in the balance. How busy are you 2 with consale duties?"
"Hardly busy," said Dexa. "We partly recess during election season. Carthane all but runs itself, barring emergencies."
Epitalus mouthed something under his breath, and Locke was sure it was "bless the presence." "Good," said Locke. "I'd like you 2 to do me a favour. Go after some undecided voters in districts outside your own. Make personal calls. Important people, the cream of the middle bunch. I'm sure you can think of 100 candidates. Charm us votes 1 by 1 in the districts where every one of those votes will count. Does that sound agreeable?"
"With all due respect, Master Lazari," said Epitalus, "that's simply not how it's done here in Carthane."
"I doubt your counterparts in the hierarchy of the Black Iris would quibble at such a task."
"It's simply not how things are done where folk of substance are concerned," said Dexa gently, as though explaining to a very small child that fire was hot.
"We have higher expectations than the Black Iris," said Epitalus. "Firmer standards. We don't scuttle about courting just anyone, Master Lazari. Surely you can see that it would make us look beggarly."
"I doubt that any of the recipients of the solicitations I propose," said Locke,
would be anything but deeply flattered to receive someone of your stature.
We don't mean them, said Dexter. Rather, our fellow members of the Deep Roots. This sort of behavior could not be countenanced.
I see, said Locke. Never mind that these scruples have brought you embarrassing defeat in the last two elections. Never mind that you will apply your firmer standards to a smaller and smaller circle of associates with ever-shrinking influence should you blithely allow the Black Iris to best you again.
Now, now, dear Master Lazari, said Dexter, surely there's no cause.
I am charged with winning this election, said Locke. To do so, I will bend every custom that must be bent. If I lack your full confidence, you may have my
Oh, no, said Epitalus. No, please.
Once again, Locke saw the curious working of the arts of the Bonds Magi as the ingrained prejudices of the Carthani warred with their conditioning to see him as some sort of cross between a spymaster and a prophet. It was something behind their eyes, and though it seemed to be going his way, he thought it best to lay on some sweetness for added assurance. "I would hardly ask this of you," he said soothingly, "if I didn't believe that I was sending you out to certain success. Your quality and grace will knock these individuals into our camp straight away, and since you'll be choosing them yourselves, they'll bring the Deep Roots nothing but credit. Get us 100 or so. Winning will be worth it, I assure you." Dexter and Epitalus acquiesced, not energetically, to be sure, but Locke was satisfied that their nods were sincere.
"Splendid," he said. "Now I've got a dinner appointment. Business appointment. Something, that could really work to our advantage. Master Callus will be here if you need anything."
"I thought you were overdressed for a planning session," said Dexter.
"What about poor Vialupa?" said Epitalus.
"Hmm? Oh, Nikoros. Let him sleep on for a bit. He'll be up to his ass in baskets and green ribbons tomorrow." Locke made several pointless adjustments to his dark blue coat and brushed imaginary dust from his black silk cravat. "And if I don't come back," he muttered to Jean,
"I'll knock the sign of the Black Iris into its own foundation and put Sabatha on a ship to Talisham."
"Comforting," Locke whispered. "Right, I've got to go wait for the carriage. Pin a note to Nikoros Lapel, would you? I'm still waiting on that bloody alchemist and constable." 8. The carriage was on time and comfortable, but Locke rode alertly, with the compartment windows open and one hand in a coat pocket. He could have instantly conjured lockpicks, a dagger, a blackjack, or a small steel pry bar, as the situation required. However, before any need arose for the tricks in his coat, the ride came to an end beneath a warmly lit stone tower somewhere in what Locke guessed was the Silverchase district. At least a dozen well-dressed gentlefolk were visible, seemingly at ease. A footman in a red silk coat opened the carriage door for him and bowed.
"Welcome to the oversight, Master Lazari," said the footman as Locke stepped onto the curb. "Your party's already waiting, if you'll follow me."
Allowing himself to hope that there might be an actual dinner rather than an ambush forthcoming, Locke glanced up and was startled. Spherical brass cages anointed with alchemical lanterns circled the highest level of the tower. These were suspended by some complex mechanical apparatus and formed a sort of gleaming halo, perhaps 70 feet above the ground. As the footman led him around the tower along a hedged path, Locke heard a muted rumbling from overhead. The cage on the side directly opposite the carriage park descended smoothly and settled into a circle of pavement about 5 yards across. The footman seized 2 levers and pulled open the cage's door, revealing the luxurious interior and Sabatha. She wore a buttercream gown under a jacket the color of rich dark brandy, and her hair fell loose past her shoulders. She was seated on a cushion, Jereshti fashion, legs crossed behind a knee-high table. Dazed by the sight of her and the strangeness of their surroundings, Locke meekly entered the cage and knelt on his own cushion. The footman resealed the door, and after a moment the cage crept upward, worked by some mechanism that was no doubt obsessively oiled in deference to the delicate ears of diners.
"If you'd wanted me to be ready earlier," he said, "I'd have been happy—"
"Oh, Tisk,"
How could I be properly mysterious and alluring if I wasn't calmly waiting for you when the door opened?
You could manage it somehow.
Locke studied the cage more closely. Although the table was ringed by gauze curtains, these were presently pulled up to the ceiling and tied in place. The cage was composed of thin bars laid in a grid with spaces about an inch on a side, through which Locke had a view of northeastern Carthane under the gold-red lines of fading sunset. They punish criminals back home with a contraption like this.
Well, in Carthane, criminals pay for the privilege of being hoisted, said Sabatha. I was told that the oversight was actually inspired by the Palace of Patience. Something about how the West gentles and perfects the ways of the East.
I've been out here for several years, and I don't feel gentled or perfected, said Locke.
Indeed, you haven't even offered to pour the wine yet, said Sabatha with mock disdain.
Oh, damn, said Locke, stumbling back to his feet. There was a bottle of something airing on the table next to a trio of glasses. He did his duty gracefully, filling two glasses and offering one to her with an exaggerated bow.
Better, but you forgot some of us, she said, pointing to the empty glass.
Hmm? Proximity to Sabatha was like sand in the gears of his mind. He imagined that he could literally feel them straining to turn as he stared at the empty glass, and then came a warm rush of shame.
Hell and castration, he muttered as he poured again, and then, a glass poured to air for absent friends. May the crooked warden bless his crooked servants. Chains, Carlo, Galdo, and Bug.
May they laugh forever in better worlds than this, said Sabatha, touching Locke's glass. They both took small sips. It was a good vintage, mellow and strong, tasting of plums and bitter oranges.
Locke sat on his cushion again, and they shared an awkward pause.
Sorry, she said. I didn't mean to give things a melancholy turn.
I know.
Locke sipped his wine again, reasoning that if it was drugged, all of his hopes and assumptions were useless anyway. The miniature arsenal in his coat suddenly struck him as comical. So, do you like the flower I brought you?
The invisible flower? The hypothetical flower?
Locke arched his eyebrows and tapped the right side of his coat. Sabatha looked down, hurriedly patted her own jacket, and pulled out an unfurled stemless rose, dark purple petals limned with crimson on their tips.
"Oh, you clever little weasel," she said, while you poured the wine.
"And you were watching the bottle rather than the bow," said Locke with a theatrical sigh. "It's fine. My pride's had all the stiffness trampled out of it already. I hope you like the colour, though. Carthani hothouse. It had a stem, but that made it too awkward to carry or palm.
I don't mind at all."
She set the rose carefully in the middle of the table. "Assuming it doesn't explode or put me to sleep or anything."
"I've forsworn vengeance on that score," said Locke. "But we do need to talk about that, so we might as well get it over with."
"What's to talk about?"
"Kidnapping," said Locke. "Assault, exile, alchemy, dirty tricks of that nature aimed at you or me or Jean."
"We learned a dozen ways to incapacitate someone before we were 10," said Sabatha. "It's perfectly routine for us. I agreed to a truce tonight."
"We should extend the truce permanently," said Locke. "Mutual immunity from direct personal attack. If we're going to have this fight, let's have it mind to mind, plan to plan, and not need to sleep under our beds because we're afraid of waking up on a ship the next day."
"I'm not afraid of waking up on a ship."
"Push your luck, gorgeous, and eventually luck pushes back. I might be dim enough to have dinner with you in a metal cage, but consider Jean. If he's free to make his own moves, he'll squash your little army like boiled goose liver, and you'll be on your way to Talisham in a box."
"Fearsome as that, is he?
Tell me again how many people you detailed to catch him while you were busy drugging me."
"And if the bonds magi interpret this as collusion?"
"It's nothing of the sort. Hell, this only increases our entertainment value for our jackass masters. They want us to run this affair in our accustomed style. Skullduggery, not skullcrackery. And you can't tell me it wouldn't tickle your own pride."
"Just to be clear, you're suggesting that I should discard an approach which has already brought me one considerable success and continue the fight at a level more suited to the restraints of your own, well, inadequacy,
and I should do this because it'll make me feel the warm glow of virtue?
I suppose if you discard the lovely emotional resonance of my suggestion and pin me down on cold, hard meaning...
How strange. You sound rather like a confidence trickster. But I've no objection to ending a little game while I'm one up on you, she said with a thin smile. Truce as discussed, strictly limited to you and Jean and myself, so we can have more time to worry about the proper contest. Will you drink to it?
Full glass is an empty promise, said Locke. Their glasses rang as they brought them together, and then they both gulped their wine to the last drop.
Doubles or dishonor, said Sabitha, speedily refilling the wine.
Again they raced one another to the bottoms of their glasses, and when they finished, her laugh seemed genuine enough to make Locke feel like a fresh wind had blown across whatever was smouldering in his heart.
You have no idea, he said, as the warm cloud of wine haze steadily rose from his chest to his head, how much aggravation I really am willing to put up with to hear that laugh again.
Oh, shit, she said, rolling her eyes without banishing her smile. Straight from business to skirt chasing.
You're the one plying me with wine.
Any woman of sense does prefer her men drunk and tractable. And now you're speaking of me possessively?
Gods, keep doing that.
This is a far cry from the dusty mess that stormed my inn and accused me of cruelly tugging his heartstrings.
You try 4 days in the saddle without preparation and see what kind of mood it leaves you in.
Their conversation was interrupted as an iron plank slid out from the tower and locked into place beside their cage. A waiter appeared and opened a door in the brass gridwork, through which he made several trips to deliver fresh wine and starter courses on gilded platters.
"I hope you don't mind that I ordered for you," said Sabitha.
"I'm at your mercy," said Locke, whose stomach now grumbled achingly to life. Fortunately, Sabitha seemed sensitive to the awkwardness of his new appetite. She ravaged their dishes with indelicate gusto that matched his own. There were the underwater mushrooms of the Amethel, translucent and steamed to the texture of gossamer, paired with coal-black truffles in malt and mustard sauce. There were cool buttercream cheeses and crackling caustic golden peppers. Spicy fried bread with sweet onions was drizzled with tart yellow yogurt, a variation on a dish Locke recognized from the cuisine of Cyrene. Each of these courses was bookended with wine and more wine. Though Locke felt his own wits softening, he was heartened to see the deepening blush on Sabitha's cheeks and the way her smiles grew steadily wider and easier as the evening wore on. Purple twilight became full dark of night, and Carthay in a sea of half-shadowed shapes suspended between blackness and alchemical sparks. The main course was a turtle crafted to life-size from glazed, parti-coloured breads. The top of the starchy creature's shell was paper-thin, and when punched through with a serving ladle, it proved to contain a lake of turtle and oyster ragout. The turtle came under enthusiastic siege from both ends of the table.
"Have you ever had a chance to look out over the Issa Scholastica before?" said Sabitha, recovering some measure of ladylike delicacy by dabbing at her chin with a silk cloth. "That's it down behind me, just across the canal. Isle of Scholars, home of the Magi, or so they claim."
"Claim? No, I've never had a chance to see it. I can't see much now, between the darkness and the wine."
"They don't seem to frown on people building towers around the edges of their little sanctuary. I've been sightseeing up a few. I say claim, because I'm not sure I believe they all live happily together like collegium students in rooms. I think they're all over the place. I think the Issa Scholastica is just where they want everyone looking."
"All those parks and buildings and so forth down there are just a sham?"
"No, I'm pretty sure they use the place, just not as a sole residence." She took a final long draught of wine and pushed her glass aside. "Though I don't believe I've ever seen one down there. Not one."
"What, would they wear signs or something? Funny hats? They're easy enough to spot when you can see their wrists and their manners, but at a distance they must look like other people."
"I've seen servants," said Sabitha, "people driving carts, offloading things, but those wouldn't be bonds, Magi, surely. I've never seen anyone strolling the Issa Scholastica at leisure, or giving orders, or simply talking to anyone else. No guards, no masters and mistresses, only servants.
If they're down there, they conceal themselves, even from eyes that are hundreds of yards away.
They're odd people, said Locke, staring into the pale orange dregs of his own wine. And I say that as a fully qualified professional odd person of the first degree. I wish they weren't such arrogant pricks, but I suppose odd people will keep odd habits.
I wonder, said Sabitha, do you feel that your handlers have been entirely candid with you concerning their motives for this contest of theirs?
Hells no, said Locke, but that was an easy question. Perhaps you've not met my side of the Magi family. Why, do you think that yours are—
I don't know, she said quietly, staring out into the night. They've delivered all the tools they said they would. They seem happy with my work, and I think their promises of consequences are certainly sincere. But their secrecy, their misdirection, it's just so habitual.
You're really not used to feeling like a piece on a game board, said Locke.
No,
she said, and then she brought her brief moment of wistfulness to an end by sticking her tongue out at him.
I haven't had all the opportunities you have to get acclimated to the sensation.
Oh-ho, serpent in a dress! Well, if only I wasn't too much the gentleman to flay your spirit with a witty and cutting retort, madam, you'd be thoroughly, wittily retorted at this very instant.
If you were any sort of actual gentleman, you'd be no fun to have dinner with.
You admit you're having fun?
I admit it's much as I feared.
She looked down at the table for a moment before continuing.
Your presence is steadily less of a chore and more of a comfort.
Well, said Locke, chuckling, aren't I always delighted to be not quite the burden you were expecting?
Dessert?
Would you forgive me if I begged off? Locke patted his stomach, which had mercifully reached the sheer physical limit of its gluttony. I'm stuffed like a grain bag.
Good. You're still too bloody thin.
The waiter cleared their dishes and left a slate with a folded note pinned to it. Sabitha picked it up and glanced at it idly. What's that?
Itemized bill, she said. They actually bring it to the table here. It's all the rage. Let's those that can read show it off in public.
Strange, said Locke, but that's the West for you. So what now, Mistress Galante? A walk, a carriage ride, maybe an—
Now we rest on our laurels.
She rose from the table and stretched, revealing how precisely her gown and jacket were fitted to her curves.
Look, it's not that I haven't appreciated the break, but some things just have to go slow.
Slow, said Locke, knowing he was failing miserably to conceal his disappointment. Of course.
Slow, she repeated. We've got 5 years and more of sharp edges to file down. I might be willing to work at it, but I don't think I can do it in one night.
I see.
Oh, don't give me that drowning puppy look.
She touched his waist and gave him a kiss on the cheek that was not quite passionate, but a shade longer than merely polite.
Let's do this again. 3 nights hence. I'll pick some other interesting place.
3 nights hence, said Locke, still feeling the warm press of her lips against his skin. 3 nights. All right. Just try and stop me.
I can't. I seem to have promised to fight clean.
She drew a pair of leather gloves from her jacket and pulled them on. Can I at least walk you to your carriage?
Don't think so, she said mischievously. I try to live by a cardinal rule of our shared profession, namely, always leave a sucker wanting more.
She reached under the table and pulled out a coil of demi-silk rope previously hidden there. Locke watched, puzzled, as she conjured a slender metal pick in her other hand and applied it to the mechanism of the waiter's door. It opened in seconds. Hey, wait a minute!
It was in case you tried anything tricky. Whether I would have used it to escape or hang you can remain an open question.
Are you serious?
I wouldn't say that, she said with a grin, but I'm definitely sincere. Thanks for the flower. I left you a little something in exchange.
Then she was gone. The rope was anchored to a point on the cage beneath the table. Sabitha kicked it out the door and rappelled into the night without a harness, sliding down on the friction of boots and gloves with her gown billowing like the petals of a wind-whipped flower.
"God's damn!"
whispered Locke as he watched her land safely and vanish far below. After a moment her last words finally squeezed past the film of wine clinging to his brain, and he frantically patted himself down. A piece of paper was in his left jacket pocket. A note? A love letter? He unfolded it in haste and discovered the bill for dinner. 9.
Move! Move! For your life, move!
Doormen scattered from a snorting pair of barely controlled horses dragging a rickety dray tended by a single wild-eyed driver. The back of the vehicle was loaded with sacks and barrels, one of which had bled an expanding trail of grey smoke all the way down the street. With a lurching crash, the dray broke a wheel against the curb and toppled, spilling its contents in a pile before the front doors of the sign of the Black Iris.
"It's alchemy!"
The driver, a slender, white-bearded fellow in a voluminous rat-chewed coat, leapt to the ground as smoke billowed past him. Sparks leapt and flickered amidst the spilled cargo, and he unyoked his frantic animals.
"Heaps of alchemy! Fetch water and sand, or run for your goddamned lives!"
Patrons, servants, and guards poured out of the inn to investigate the commotion, only to reel back in dismay as smoke boiled past them into the building. Crackling noises rose ominously within the haze, and fires of eerie colours burst to life. The driver of the crashed dray led his horses across the street, where he found several boys in Black Iris livery watching the unfolding disaster.
"Here!"
he shouted, thrusting the reins into one boy's hands.
"Watch my animals! I'll be right back!"
The bearded man scuttled across the street and into the billowing murk. Green smoke, red smoke, and mustard yellow smoke uncoiled from the spreading fire, tendrils wafting like sinister serpents of the air. The new hazes bore nauseating odors of garlic, brimstone, and mortified flesh. The entire street side of the sign of the Black Iris was subsumed in a picturesque alchemical nightmare. More or less hidden in the rising smoke, through which the masked afternoon sun shone dimly bronze, the driver darted down an alley beside the inn. He threw his coat and hat behind a pile of empty crates, then yanked away his baggy trousers and boots to reveal black hose and polished shoes. The beard was the last to go. Freshly peeled like a human fruit, smooth-cheeked and well-dressed, Locke Lamora strolled casually out the end of the smoky alley and into the court behind the inn.
"Master Lazari, good oof afternoon."
Sabatha rolled off the lowest eave on the sign of the Black Iris rear side, landed hard, recovered gracefully, and offered a half-curtsy from about 10 feet away. Three of her security folk followed her, landed awkwardly, and spread out in an arc around Locke. The window they'd spilled out of remained open, its shutters swaying in the soft breeze.
"Oh, hello, Mistress Galante," said Locke cheerfully. "Having problems with your inn?"
"Nothing that can't be corrected with a little assistance, I'm sure."
"I do wish I could help," said Locke. "I just happened to be nearby." "Ah, I remember now. You're having some sort of big Black Iris party meeting today, aren't you? My condolences. The smoke, the flames. I can only imagine the consternation."
"I'm sure you've imagined it in detail."
Sabatha moved close enough to lower her voice.
"Bearded peasant goes in one end of an alley, clean-shaven gentleman comes out the other? Really?"
"It's a classic.
It's got cobwebs on it. Might have fooled someone who hadn't seen you do it before. Now, do you want to come with me gracefully, or on the shoulders of my friends?"
"I remind you, darling, my person is inviolable."
"Don't call me that when we've got our working faces on, and nobody's person is getting violated, but you can't think I'm going to let you stroll away while a cart full of alchemical crap burns on my doorstep."
"Of course I can. It's all perfectly harmless," said Locke. "Oh, it might smell awful, and some of it reacts badly with water, and there's just no telling what's what until you experiment. But give it a few hours, then air your inn out for a day or two. There won't be any lingering issues."
"All the same, I think you should sit in a little room and be bored until I've got the mess under control."
"Now, now," said Locke, "you must credit me with the foresight to have a backup plan in case you decided to take it like this.
And, of course, you must expect me to have one of my own in case you wanted to play hard to get," she said.
Oh, absolutely. Well, she ran a finger lightly up and down one of the lapels of his jacket. I'll show you mine if you show me yours.
You! Hold it right there!
The shout echoed down the courtyard as a trio of surcoated constables appeared out of the drifting smoke. The leader, a man with a wheat-coloured beard and the aesthetic qualities of a lard slab, touched Locke on the shoulder with a wooden baton.
As a constable of Carthane, sir, I must formally detain you, he said.
How dreadful, Locke feigned a yawn. What's the charge?
You resemble a suspect wanted for questioning in a confidential matter. You'll have to come with us.
Alas. Locke allowed the constables to gather loosely around him and doffed an imaginary hat to Sabitha as he backed away with them. Varina, I wish I could continue our conversation, but it seems the deficiencies of my character have become a matter of official concern. Best of luck dealing with your little conflagration. Just before the smoke cloud swallowed him again, Locke rapidly gestured in code, looking forward to tomorrow night. Her response was a gesture, though not one originating in the private signals of the gentleman bastards. Still, Locke felt reassured by the fact that she smiled as she delivered it. The street before the sign of the Black Iris was a reeking mess. Well-dressed men and women with black flowers pinned to their jackets sought escape, while well-meaning people with buckets of water tripped over one another and tumbled around like billiard balls. The alchemical fires burned merrily on, a partial rainbow of sorcerous lights within the miasma. Locke's captors walked with him for about a block before detouring into an empty, windowless court. "Beautifully timed, Sergeant," said Locke, producing three leather purses of equal size. "Worthy of applause."
"We take pride in the conduct of our civic duty," said the bearded man.
He and his cohorts accepted the purses with wide grins. Each had earned 3 months' wages for the few minutes spent loitering nearby in case of Locke's need. It was downright pleasant, thought Locke, to be treading the old familiar realms of avarice after dealing with the eerie malleability of the adjusted Deep Roots people.
"No, none of that stuff is really dangerous, right?" said the sergeant, one bushy eyebrow raised.
"Harmless as baby spit," said Locke, "as long as nobody's dim enough to shove their hand into a fire." Satisfied, the constables took their leave. Locke had only a few minutes to wait before Jean came strolling down the avenue from the direction of the smoke, several empty sacks flung over his shoulder. "How'd it go up top?" said Locke, as the two of them fell into step together.
"Perfection and then some," said Jean. "They were all so distracted. Bothering to sneak might have been a waste of time. That's 37 snakes down the cold chimneys.
Magnificently childish, though I say it myself." Locke scratched at his chin to remove a few stubborn flecks of beard adhesive. "Hopefully that'll keep them uneasy for a few days."
"And if she responds with more of the same?"
"I arranged to have city work gangs do some unnecessary mucking with the cobblestones around Justin's for the next few days. No carriages can get closer than 20 yards. Our friends will grumble, but that should keep loads of mischief at a distance." As they walked, Locke noticed for the first time that banners had started to appear, hanging from balconies and windows. Here and there were a few brave greens, but in this neighborhood the majority were black. Citizen interest was climbing. Half the allotted 6 weeks was nearly gone. Annoying pranks were a fine gambit, but now it was time to begin truly curbing some of Sabitha's capabilities. "Those spies keeping watch on our place," said Locke. "Fancy a little hospitality visit once the sun goes down?" 10. Their second night of upper-story work went as smoothly as the first. They swept the block surrounding Justin's comprehensive just after midnight, creeping silently through rooftop gardens and over well-tended slate roofs, using chimneys and parapets for cover. Not everyone they crossed paths with was in Sabitha's pay. A drunk woman, huddled in the corner of her terrace, was sobbing over a small painting and didn't notice them slip past. Two lithe young men, wrapped in one another's arms a few gardens over, were similarly absorbed.
Locke crept past their cast-off clothes, close enough to sift them for purses, but pangs of sympathy stilled the impulse. Doing mischief to happy lovers might invite a cruel justice to trample his own hopes. Their first legitimate target was taken unawares, and his possessions made his job plain. He wore a mottled grey-brown cloak, ideal for blending into city shadows, carried a spyglass, and the remains of a cold meal were spread beside his hiding place. In an instant, Jean flung him down on his stomach and crouched atop him, wrenching the poor fellow's arms behind his back. Locke knelt at the man's head, bemused at how familiar he and Jean were becoming with the old, threatening voice, silent brawn act. "You try to cry out," whispered Locke, "and we'll rip your arms off. Shove one down your throat and one up your ass, so you'll look like meat on a spit. How many of you are watching Jostens?"
"I don't know," hissed the man.
Locke gave him a shove on the back of the head, bouncing his face off the roof tiles. Hard, but not too hard. "It's not worth it," said Locke. "Your employer doesn't expect life or death loyalty, surely. But we will hurt you to send a message."
"There's one more," spat their captive. "One that I know of. Maybe more. Look out past this parapet. 4 rows down, roof of the apothecary shop. He's there somewhere. I swear that's all I can tell you."
"Good enough," said Locke. He pulled his dagger and slashed the man's cloak into strips. When Sabatha's agent was gagged and thoroughly trussed, Locke gave him a pat on the back. "Now, don't fret. Once we've finished clearing out all your friends, we'll tip one of them off and you'll be collected. Shouldn't be more than a few hours. Don't do anything stupid." The second agent was crouched atop the apothecary shop as indicated, but he was a touch more alert and met them with a drawn cosh. What followed was a proper scrum, with Locke clinging to the man's legs while Jean attempted to wrestle and disarm him, hampered by the need to avoid killing him. Such was the fellow's fighting spirit that they ultimately had to pummel him unconscious before they could have a word. As they neared the end of their circuit around the neighborhood, perhaps 10 minutes later, they found a third and likely final observer, fortunately no more on guard than the first.
"All your friends are dealt with,"
said Jean cheerfully as he dangled the man over the back alley side of the building by his jacket collar.
"Trussed up like festival chickens."
"Great gods, mate, it's nothing personal," sobbed the man as he stared into the shadows 4 stories below. "We're just doing our bloody job."
"Find another job," said Locke. "This is us being very, very cordial. Next time we catch spies lurking in this neighborhood, we cripple them. This isn't Carthane right now. It's the sovereign state of fuck off and go home."
"But..."
"Take a good look at that alley," said Locke. "Imagine what those cold, hard stones will feel like when we throw you off this roof. You come round here again, you'd best have wings. Now, your comrades are tied up in their usual spots. Fetch them and run hard."
"Couldn't we discuss..."
"Get the dog shit out of your ears, you witless corpse fart," growled Jean. "Do you want to do as you're told, or do you want to kiss that pavement?"
It turned out he wanted to do as he was told. 11.
"Have you ever thought about how badly chains fucked us all up?"
"Gods above!" Locke narrowly avoided choking on his beer. "How tipsy are you?"
"Not at all."
Sabatha held her own glass rock steady for several moments to support the assertion. "I understand your frustration with the way some things played out," said Locke. "You know I listened to you."
"I do."
"And you know I think you had some points, but Chains was a generous man, a generous and caring man, whatever his faults."
"That's not what I'm talking about. He wanted a family, very desperately. You've realized that?"
"Of course. I never thought of it as a defect."
"I often think he wanted a family more than he wanted a gang."
"Again?"
"A conscience is a dead weight in our profession." She stared into the amber depths of her half-full glass. "Make no mistake, he shackled each of us with one. Even Carlo and Galdo, rest their souls. For all they did most of their thinking with their cocks and the rest with their balls, even they wound up with essentially kindly dispositions. Chains got us all in the end, good and hard." Their second dinner, the night following the alchemical disaster at the sign of the Black Iris, was held aboard the Merry Drifter, a flat-topped dining barge complete with gardens and lacquered privacy screens. The barge had floated gently through the heart of Carthane, beneath the strange music of the elderglass bridges, before finally laying anchor in the Amethyll just off the Ponta Corbessa. As the sky had darkened and the alchemical globes flicked to life, little boats had ferried other diners to and from shore, but Locke and Sabatha had had their choice table at the barge's stern all the while. "I can't believe I'm hearing this from someone who came out of Shades Hill," said Locke. "Is that what you would have preferred? Getting beaten and starved? Maybe buggered here and there when it suited him?" "Of course not. Sabatha, you know how much I respect you. But if you can't see what a god's damned paradise we lucked into when chains picked us, you need to set that beer down this instant." "I don't regret the comforts or the education. He was a faultless provider, except in one respect. He trained a gentle streak into us and let us pretend it would never cost us. You think we should have been more cruel? Ready to turn on each other like sharks in blood, like every other god's damned gang around us? I don't know what's gotten into you, but that wasn't weakness he bred into us. It was loyalty, and loyalty's a hell of a weapon."
"You have the luxury of thinking so."
"Oh, not this again. The Jean situation, right? Straight and simple, gorgeous, don't you dare sit there and hit me with self-righteous envy for a friendship I kept and you walked away from." She set her beer down and stared coldly at him. Then, just as Locke's heart started to sink in expectation of another one of their habitual misunderstandings, the chill thawed and she attempted a smile. She whistled, mimicking the sound of an arrow in flight, and clutched at an imaginary shaft just above her heart. "I'm sorry," they both said, in Sansa-esque unison, and chuckled. "You're dwelling on something," said Locke, reaching across the table to rest his free hand on hers. "Let it go. Just be here. Just be Sabatha, having dinner, floating on the Amethyll. Let the world end at the sides of this barge."
"I am dwelling on something."
"Well, don't take such a poisonous view of our upbringing. Come on. We lie for a living. It's not healthy for us to lie to ourselves."
"What do we do but lie to ourselves, Locke? Aren't we supposed to be rich? Aren't we supposed to be in command of our lives, free to go when and where we please, with all the honest simpletons of the world throwing coins at our feet? Here we are, halfway around the world, working for the god's damned bonds magi just to stay alive.
You know, Jean slapped me out of a lot of moods like the one you're in right now." Locke took a long pull on his beer. "You're taking the world awfully personally. Didn't Chains ever tell you about the golden theological principle?"
"The what?"
"The single congruent aspect of every known religion, the one shared universal assumption about the human condition."
"What is it?"
"He said that life boils down to standing in line to get shit dropped on your head. Everyone's got a place in the queue, you can't get out of it. And just when you start to congratulate yourself on surviving your dose of shit, you discover that the line is actually circular."
"I'm just old enough to find that distressingly accurate."
"You see, it's universal," said Locke. "Of course, I'm a stark, staring hypocrite for telling you not to take it personally. It's easy to prescribe remedies for our own weaknesses when they're comfortably ensconced in other people. What's got you dwelling on the past?"
"I don't like dancing on strings, any strings, even my own. I've been examining some, I suppose, trying to follow them all the way back to where they began."
"Ah," Locke shuffled his glass around idly. "You're trying to reconcile your contradictory thoughts about yours truly, and you're wondering what sort of decision you'd be making without our shared history."
"God damn it!"
Sabatha punctuated this exclamation by throwing a wadded-up silk napkin at him.
"Don't do that! It makes me feel as though my thoughts are written on my forehead."
"Come now, fair's fair. You read me like a scroll."
"I tried to get you out of the way."
"Half-assed," said Locke. "Very half-assed. Admit it. You made it difficult, but some part of you wanted to see Jean and me get off that ship and come riding back into town."
"I don't know. I wanted to see you, but then I wanted you gone," said Sabatha. "I tried to say no to dinner. I couldn't. I don't want anyone to be a habit for me, Locke.
If I love someone, I want it to be my choice. I want it to be the right choice. I never felt as though I had a choice, from the first hours I knew you. Remember when I told you, for the first time, you nearly threw me off the roof? I thought you deserved it. You know, it's an opinion I return to from time to time, whether or not a roof is available. You're a difficult woman, Sabitha. But then difficult women are the only ones worth falling in love with. How would you know? It's not like you've ever been after anyone else. That part's easy. I started with the most difficult woman possible, so there was never any need to look any further. You're trying to be charming. She squeezed his hand once, then pulled away. I choose not to be entirely charmed, Locke Lamora. Not entirely? Not entirely. Not yet. Well, Locke sighed. The evening might not be ending as he'd dared to hope, but that was no reason to be less than good company. I suppose I still have two ambitions to mind as long as I'm in Carthane. Dessert? How about a ride back to shore? I've been curious about what might happen when you suggested that. Will you be leaving by catapult? Giant kite? One showy exit was amusing, two would be gauche. We can't let these Westerners think Komori are entirely without a sense of restraint. Their ride back to shore was a flat-bottomed boat with velvet cushions, tended by an admirably mum old fellow rowing at the stern. Locke and Sabitha rode side by side in companionable silence, through waters that gleamed white and blue from the lanterns of the dining barge. The air was full of pale, fluttering streaks, pulsing like fireflies, adding their soft touches of light to the canvas of the water.
"Firelight sovereigns," whispered Sabitha. "Carthani night butterflies. It's said they hatch at dusk and die with the dawn."
"You and I are natives of the dark, too," said Locke. "I'm glad some of us last a bit longer." Two carriages waited above the quayside. "His and hers, I presume?" said Locke.
"To bear us back to ribbons and duties and dumping carts of burning alchemy on doorsteps."
She led him to the first carriage and held the door open. "The driver has Jean's hatchets, safe and sound, to be handed over on arrival." "Thanks. So, 3 nights hence?" He took her hand as he placed one foot on the step, and bit the inside of his cheek to keep from grinning too broadly when she didn't draw away. "Come on, you know you want to say yes."
3 nights. I'll send a carriage. However, I'm charging you with finding a place this time. You've roamed the city enough to have some ideas, I think."
"Oh, I'm full of ideas." He bowed and kissed the back of her hand, then climbed into the carriage. "Can I offer you one last thing?"
"You can offer."
She pushed the door shut and looked in at him through the barred window.
"Quit being so hard on yourself. We are what we are. We love what we love. We don't need to justify it to anyone, not even to ourselves.
I seem to remember telling you that before."
"Thank you."
She did something to the lock on the carriage door.
"We are what we are. Now listen, my driver will let you out when you're back home.
Don't bother messing with the door. I had the lock mechanism sealed on the inside."
"What? Wait a damned minute. What are you—"
"Have a smooth ride," she said, waving. "And I want you to know that the bit with the snakes was pretty cute. In fact, I took pains to see that they weren't harmed, because I was certain you'd want such adorable little creatures returned to you."
She thumped the side of the carriage twice. A panel in the cabin ceiling above Locke slid open, and as the carriage clattered across the cobbles, the rain of snakes began. 12. "Paint me a picture," said Locke, standing in the Deep Roots private gallery 2 days later. Since his return from dinner with a carriage full of less than deadly but agitated serpents, he'd been consumed by the paper chase, poring over maps and allocating funds, checking and double-checking lists, with no chance to engage in more hands-on weasel work.
"Nikoros just went down to fetch the latest reports," said Jean, blowing smoke from an aromatic Siresti leaf cigar that would have cost a common laborer a day's wages. "But our consail members here have been chatting their teeth out in all the better parts of town."
"Successfully, too, I should think."
Damned superstition Dexa took a sip from her brandy snifter and gestured at the map of Carthane with her own cigar.
Asceticism was a virtue the Deep Roots Party held in slight regard.
"We've squeezed a lot of promises out of Plaza Gandolo and the Palanta District, fence-sitters mostly, and some old friends we've brought back into the fold."
"Bought back is more like it," said First Son Epitalus. "Bloody ingrates!"
"What are you handing out to steady their resolve?" said Locke.
"Oh, hints about tax easements," said Dexter. "Everyone loves the thought of keeping a little more of their own money."
"The Black Aris people can drop the same hints," said Locke. "I don't mean to tell you your business, but fuck me. If something as boring as tax easements is enough to hook votes, those people won't care which party delivers the goods. We need some impractical reasons to motivate them. Emotional reasons. That means rumour-mongering. I want to rub dirt on whoever's standing for the Black Aris in those districts. Something disgusting. In fact, we'll completely avoid mud-flinging in a few other spots to make these stand out all the more. What's guaranteed to repulse the good voters of Carthane?"
"Rather depends on how much vulgarity you're willing to countenance, dear boy."
Dexa drew in a long breath of smoke while she pondered. "Third Son Jovindus, that's their lad for the Palanta district. He's got what you might call an open-door policy for the contents of his breeches, but he's also just dashing enough to carry it off."
"Second daughter Viracoy stands for them in Plaza Gandolo,"